Welcome one and all to episode 87 of the NFL Draft Breakdown Podcast. I'm your host, Seth Cox. With me tonight, my co-host, Justin Higdon. And Justin, we're joined by another brave soul who wants to revisit their 2014 NFL Draft rankings, our good friend, Ian Wharton. Ian, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, man. A little bit of a tough break today with Chester Bennington. That news, he was a very personal favorite of mine, but other than that, I'm doing pretty well. Had the pleasure of meeting you guys in person last week, which was awesome. And now back down here in the summer heat of Houston. So trying to survive Texas in July, which is always brutal.
Yeah, Seth and I had the pleasure of having lunch with Ian last weekend. And I think it's important to note, Ian, that Seth attempted to order the avocado toast.
And, he did.
But, you know, because all the millennials must have beat us to lunch that day, it was sold out. So he was not able to actually eat the avocado toast. He had to order something else.
That's right. You guys beat me to lunch and ate all the avocado and blue crab toast, and now I'm upset still. So, but
we got triggered.
Yeah, I had a little trigger. We got to hang out. We got to talk NFL draft. We got to talk football. We got to talk about actual real life and things that matter. And it was a lot of fun. And of course, we had to have Ian back on the show because Ian is one of the guys that, one, we always lean on for information, but two, he's somebody that's willing to, you know, kind of talk about what he missed, what he did well on, and how he's evolved as a analyst. And, you know, one of the things we like to do during summer is listen to these guys talk about how their process has changed and grown and evolved into what it is today. And you said something on the show, or, you know, off the air before the show started, Ian, that I kind of want to start with, and then we'll get into the rest of the topics. But you talked about how if you went back and charted Derek Carr now, as opposed to 2014, you would be lower on him and as a prospect. And can you, and then, you know, you obviously ended with, and just in reality, quarterbacks are hard to scout anyways, which is the most truthful statement in all of, you know, NFL draft evaluation. But can you explain to, you know, the listeners why that would be, and how Carr in the NFL hasn't or wouldn't affect your scouting of Carr, the NFL prospect?
Yeah, so I think it's very important to differentiate the two whenever looking at any player, but especially when you're looking at quarterbacks coming from such a unique situation that he did. Fresno State, it's not a Power 5 team, obviously, a Power 5 conference like Ohio State or Alabama. So, like, he's always going to face those questions about competition levels, quality of teammates. He's going to have those questions as well. Then he had a very unique scheme, Tim DeRuiter's scheme, came out of a pro-style system the first 2 years of his career, and then started to go into more of like a spread, a very vertical attack. And so that created a lot of questions about what he could handle entering the NFL. And what I found is when I went back and charted him, and for those unfamiliar, this summer I've basically gone back and charted over 40 quarterbacks from the 2013 through the 2017 class. Just looking at different accuracy numbers, trying to see where players are throwing more effectively, and then kind of looking at how that translates to the pros and how successful those players are, and trying to find some thresholds and trying to add some context to my evaluations and saying, okay, like, my eyes see that this player is good at throwing deep, but what exactly does that mean? This player is good at throwing deep, or good in situational football, third and fourth down in the red zone, third and short, like whatever it may be. And so this is just adding context to that, and it's just assigning a number value to it. It's not anything fancy, really. It's just hashtag grinding tape and trying to put some sort of, you know, numerical value to that. And so when I went back and did that for Carr, I had a late first-round grade on him. I was pretty high on him. Actually, I think Justin and I sat together, I think, at the Senior Bowl watching him a few years ago when he was at the Senior Bowl, and watching him and talking about him. And we were both kind of, I think, in similar places at that time. And so I liked him. The late first round grade probably sounds too low at this point, like when you look back at it. But when I went to see him as a prospect, I thought he actually struggled a lot more against pressure than what I seem to remember. I thought that he struggled creating outside of what the offense gave him. So in that offense, although it was very basic and it was limiting as far as revealing some of his strengths, he struggled to kind of throw deep and be effective throwing deep. It didn't give him any opportunities to create outside of that first read or that second read. And so as far as being a creator and being outside of the structure, I'm not sure I really saw what I wanted to see out of him upon that second glance. And then when you kind of looked at him towards the scope of the NFL, he's maybe been a little bit stronger in those areas and being a little bit more effective. But he also went to a situation that was drastically different than what he had at Fresno State. Oakland has one of the strongest offensive lines. They have some of the best receivers. The running game is not great, which is similar to Fresno State. And so that's one area that you could probably say that was beneficial to him because he wasn't working off of a strong running game. But they help cover up some of his weaknesses that I saw in colleges too, potentially. He may have grown in those areas, but we don't really know yet. It's still pretty early in his career and in his developmental growth. But so overall, I mean, Carr, I thought that if I were to regrade him, I, you know, late first round to me means I have a franchise quarterback expectation. He's going to be a top 12 to 15 quarterback. And I think that's correct. Like, I think that's where he is if I were to evaluate his NFL stance. But it just as a prospect going back, I probably would have had him as a day two guy, as a guy that I would have liked to have developed over a couple seasons and have a little bit lower expectations, maybe say closer to average. And so my process was, I think, has gotten better as far as confirming what my eyes see, confirming what I believe to be correct. But it may have led to a worse result on Carr had that been the case. And so just kind of an interesting dynamic when that happens.
So Ian, you actually had Teddy Bridgewater as your top quarterback, and he was way up in your top five. Talk about Bridgewater and what made him the clear quarterback one to you, because I don't think you had another quarterback for until Carr at around 22 or so. What was it about Bridgewater, and has anything changed about your process in regards to him as, you know, as what happened with Carr?
Yeah, so like we all sort of have our bias towards a certain type of players. You know, Seth, he really likes guys like Blake Bortles, who are bad quarterbacks but need to be rehabilitated. The Browns, Justin, you know, I mean, they just like bad quarterbacks. But so for me, I like
Johnny Manziel.
mostly everyone did. But, you know, Bridgewater for me, I loved his consistency. And coming out of that system where he was underneath center, it was very easy to project as far as what most NFL teams would ask him to do. Was used to turning his back on the defense, turning around, making a quick decision, throwing with excellent accuracy. I think that his ability to put the ball on the money to maximize yards after the catch, put the ball out of the defender's reach. I won't say he was too safe with the ball. I think that that's a legitimate concern, especially in the NFL, is that I think he can be too cautious at times. But I think he was very safe with it in terms of not putting it in risky situations. Maybe I'm not explaining that well, but like there weren't many turnover opportunities for the defense, and not necessarily because I thought that he was just checking down. I thought he was just putting the ball where it needed to be so that it was out of reach for the defender. So I thought that he showed that type of next level accuracy that very few quarterbacks in the NFL have. I think there's a difference between just being accurate and being precise. And I think that his precision was a standout trait and something that even upon looking back, I think only Andrew Luck has sort of matched him from the guys I've seen so far. It's not an exhaustive list, but I think that he was sort of at like the next level as far as where he was being able to consistently put the ball and maximize the offense. And so I just thought he would translate very quickly. I thought that mentally he seemed extremely bright, in part because he understood what he was seeing with the defense. He didn't take unnecessary shots downfield too often. But you would look at the concerns and you'd say probably physically he is a little bit limited, not a great downfield passer. Being able to hit those tight passing windows consistently, he sort of had to win with timing and more of that accuracy, more than physical gifts and being able to overcome maybe some issues with technique or if he had to extend the play. If his launching pad wasn't clean, was he going to be able to still make the play even if circumstances weren't perfect? And so like you look at more physically gifted quarterbacks like Carr, they can compensate for that much easier because of their physical gifts. And so I think that Bridgewater looking back at it, I mean, I had him as an elite grade. So like the way I grade players, a 9.0 or above out of 10 is an elite player. That's probably a little bit too high, just because an elite player to me would be like Andrew Luck. So I don't know that Bridgewater's at that level, although I'm still a fan of his in the NFL. You know, just kind of looking at how his career's worked out so far, it's been tough to read because Minnesota's been a tough situation. But overall, I'm not sure if he's lived up to that quite high of a grade.
You know, we made fun of it ad nauseum. The skinny knees, the build, the everything about it. And then it kind of, I mean, it came true. And now I know it's still the stupidest thing ever when you actually sit back and think about it. It really is. But is that something that we have to now take into consideration when we look at these quarterbacks? Because, and I'm not just talking about the skinny knees, but I'm just talking about build in general, that with the way the game is played today, at the physicality and at the speed it's played today, and at the amount of hits these quarterbacks are taking, not just sacks, but hits in general, you know, we have to think that these guys can physically hold up. And I know it was a knock on Bridgewater, and I know it got passed off, but did we overlook that aspect? Now, the knee thing, I mean, what happened to him in practice was such beyond a fluke, but I still think it comes back to the amount of punishment he was taking while in Minnesota that, you know, kind of triggered the what happened later type thing.
Yeah, I think that is something that maybe we need to pay more attention to. And I remember reading how Chip Kelly used to actually put a lot of stock into wrist measurement, because there's a correlation between wrist measurement and the ability for your body to continue growing. And so it depends probably on where the weaknesses lie in the quarterback. But like Jared Goff is another good example of this, and probably Teddy Bridgewater as well. Like, you want to be able to see that those guys are going to be able to add strength to their frame, especially Goff, who was so young, who was just barely 21 when he was drafted, and we saw the lack of velocity that he created on some of his passes. If he can't improve that velocity through strength training and being able to bulk up a little bit and improve his overall physique, then that makes that pick even more dubious. Just because if he can't improve on his weaknesses a little bit, then that margin for error becomes tiny. And so you probably say the same thing for Teddy Bridgewater. He wasn't a physically overwhelming guy. When he didn't have the thick quarterback jacket on, you could see he was more of a slender build. And we saw in his weight, he wasn't a heavy player. And like, that's why it probably predicted where he was going to be drafted. I think he was under 215 pounds when he was drafted, if that's correct. So there's not many quarterbacks that get drafted that high under that certain weight threshold. And it makes sense. I mean, he got pounded by with the Vikings before he got hurt. And then, of course, he gets hurt with a non-contact injury. But I think there is something to that. And I know that you guys talked about that with, like, Darren Sproles, comparing running backs to Darren Sproles and Danelle Pumphrey. They just had different frames. Like, Sproles was so thick that, like, his 180 pounds or whatever was a different 180 pounds from other backs. And so I think the same thing is at quarterback. It's like, you can't just look at 220 pounds like Jared Goff is when he's a beanpole, as opposed to, you know, say Marcus Mariota, who has a little bit more strength, has a little bit more physically gifted and a little bit more mature in that regard. And so it's tough to project that type of stuff from our seat, especially, let alone the NFL seat. I mean, it's just, you're trying to project how these young men are going to be developed into 24-year-olds when they're only 20, 21. So that can be a very difficult thing. And I do think it's important, though, especially as offenses continue to pass heavily.
So speaking of slight frames, I mentioned I like Johnny Manziel. We had Brendan Leister on our last show, and he was a huge Johnny Manziel guy. You never bought into the Manziel hype. I want to know from you, was it more about the off-the-field stuff? Were you kind of predicting – I wouldn't say anybody really predicted quite the disaster that ensued, but were you more worried about the off-the-field issues, the off-the-field, the immaturity, or were you more worried about Johnny Manziel's game? Is that why you had him rated so low?
I think it was definitely a mixture of both. When you watch Johnny Manziel it's impossible to not fall in love with the competitiveness, the leadership. Like, you could, like, you just visibly don't see guys have that much emotion and seem to have that much effect on the game just with how they play. That much was easy to love, but I had him as an early fourth round prospect, and a lot of it, 90% of that, was just I didn't care for how he played, in the sense that he was a redshirt sophomore coming from one of the simplest systems in college football. I thought that he was more of a product of Mike Evans and his greatness, as well as a very talented offensive line, than I thought that he was really creating all of that himself. And I mean, it's a two-way blade, because you need to have talent around you to be effective. But in the same sentence, like, I want him to be more successful in structure. And I thought that there's a fine balance. I mentioned structure earlier with Carr. It's like, I think there's a fine balance between saying you need to be somewhat successful in structure, but you also have to be able to create when the offense breaks down and you have to make that play. We saw Manziel being able to make that play. That wasn't really the question. The question was, for me, was he going to be able to play in an offense that required him to do a three-step drop, turn his back on, or five-step drop, turns back on the defense, and get that ball out quickly? We sort of saw that in Cleveland eventually when he had a couple of consecutive starts and sort of get his groove a little bit, but we never fully saw that realized. And it's one thing to remember too, Manziel would have been a senior last year had he been able to stay in school. He was basically pushed out of the program though. And so that's something else too. It's like, you kind of have to consider too, like, you're projecting this guy to have success. We didn't see him have success in any type of structure in college, whether it be on the field or off the field. And so why would you think that that would automatically change come the NFL? And you guys mentioned that the article before he even came out of school, where his dad was talking about, like, he's an alcoholic. Like, so, like, all the red flags were there. I thought, not to be what he is now, like, I didn't think he'd be out of the league just a few years later. Like, I think he's definitely talented enough to be in the NFL, but he was a very raw player. I thought he really needed another year or two, just because the situation there, it's a perfect scenario where the collegiate team didn't have to prepare him for the NFL, and Kevin Sumlin didn't. And so you saw that to, like, the fullest degree. It was almost like a high school kid coming into the NFL. And then the Browns, I don't know if they necessarily did the best by him either. You know, I think that's debatable. And it was a really bad set of circumstances. If he would have been more committed to the football aspect of things, I think that the talent was there to find success in the NFL, but I was still bullish on his overall upside anyways. I mean, I wasn't really looking at him as more than like an average quarterback. Generally, that would be like a day two grade for me, but everything else considering, that's what really plummeted for him, for me, comparatively.
Yeah, I think it was a total mistake to ignore his own father making those comments about, that he drinks to deal with stress. I think that should have been alarm bells. I've mentioned before that I kind of said boys will be boys, and I just think that proved not to be the case. That's probably not a guy, not only that I wouldn't be high on anymore, but I would almost kind of be hands off about that. So now, knowing what I know.
So let me ask you this in the same vein. How do you feel about Baker Mayfield?
With Mayfield, I think you've got you have a public intoxication incident. So the off the field issue, as far as I know, there's nothing deeper than this one incident. But with Mayfield, I'm more concerned that he's just not as physically talented as Manziel was at an older age. So Mayfield has never been a guy that I've been super high on, and he's not really a player that I'm looking at as a pro prospect going forward.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the off-field for Johnny was so extreme and unique. It'll be interesting to monitor, because I know PFF loves Mayfield, but he really didn't play well against good defenses. So
PFF loved Matt Johnson from Bowling Green too. So
yeah, true.
Not to dog him, but hey, I wanted to touch on this because I think we want to move past quarterbacks pretty soon. But
sure.
What was the deal with David Fales? Why was David Fales ever a thing? And obviously he went in the sixth round and has bounced around practice squads. What was it that at one point had people saying he was quarterback one? I never bought it. You never bought it. Seth never bought it. What the hell was that?
You know, I'm a Fales fan even to this day, but it was limited, a limited fan. I had him as a late fourth round prospect. To me, that is the quintessential backup. That is exactly what the NFL pays for a quality backup. We saw that with Connor Cook. We saw that with Dak Prescott. Now, obviously, Prescott blew those expectations out of the water, but that's what the expectation was for him. And I think Fales was in the same vein in the NFL's eye. From our standpoint, on our side of things, especially in 2014, there was not a filter for or a built-in cushion to sort of knock down some of these non-Power 5 quarterbacks. I think inherently we have to be skeptical about quarterbacks that aren't playing in the Power 5 conferences, because it's hard enough to find an NFL quarterback, let alone one from a small school. It's extremely difficult, especially in that system. He weighed in at 6'1", 212 pounds. You know, that's really difficult. Brandon Allen was that sort of size for Jacksonville, drafted out of Arkansas. That's just you're hitting so many red flags to say that, like, the chances are very low that this is going to be a quality NFL player. And of course, he was measured, or he was listed at 6'3", 220 at San Jose State too. So, like, you see that sort of size, you see the numbers he's putting up, almost 4,200 yards in back-to-back seasons, 33 touchdowns, only 22 career interceptions. Like, everything looked really good about him, except for when you looked at his arm strength and you said, okay, like, he's just winning by dinking and dunking for the most part. And he was a very successful collegiate quarterback. And I think that when you looked at the physical limitations of him, it's just so hard to overcome that. There is a threshold, not necessarily size, but there is a threshold in the NFL where you say, like, you just have to bet against the types that are like Chad Pennington's. Like, if your comp for someone is Chad Pennington and that's still a projection, that's a really difficult and very minuscule comparison that's worked out. For the most part, successful NFL quarterbacks don't play like that, and they don't look like that for a reason.
And if he's on a scale of Chad Pennington as his high end and Kellen Moore as his low end,
yeah,
that's, you know, and that's like, if I was doing a Fales spectrum, that's what it would be. And it's not a shot at Fales, but it, you know, both of those guys have been in the NFL for, you know, were or are in the NFL for a long time, but that's just, they're physically limited players that you have to understand what you're getting out of them or in them. And so that's, you know, but nobody wants to talk about David Fales. Everybody's going to act like they never heard of the guy. What we do need to talk about are two of the more overrated off or defensive linemen from this draft, and that was Dominic Easley and Rashid Hageman. Easley went 31-ish, I believe, to the New England Patriots. Made zero noise there, and was released. He's now a starter with the Los Angeles Rams. I think he had 3.5 sacks total in 2016. So Easley was as high as number 4 on some big boards that I remember. You had him fairly high. What did you see in Easley? And if you look back, would you have kind of given him an injury tax and moved him down a little bit?
So it's hard, because even to this day, I really just look at on the field, and I acknowledge that the injury stuff and the character stuff are things that, as a decision maker, I would definitely weigh heavily. I don't really know yet how to properly devalue players for that. So, like, as I just look at it as like a talent evaluation, I thought that I probably was too high on him. So, like, on my final board, I had him number 9 overall. I don't think he's lived up to that at all. Injuries aside, I don't think he's been that force of a player. And that was probably predicted in college. He only had one season where he had 4 sacks, and then he had 1.5 sacks in the season before that. So, like, he was never that dominant, consistent force in college. And we sort of see this every year or two where there's just a guy who looks great on film. Danielle Hunter's probably one of the few guys, and Chris Jones are probably two of the guys that have sort of bucked that trend and actually been really good in the NFL. But it's more of like the eye test. And he was a really good athlete, and I think I just banked on him being that great athlete consistently. And he was so fun to watch because he would do all this stuff pre-snap. And you just sort of like romanticize, or at least I romanticized that fun in him. And he was at times devastating as far as his pressures. But like, that's why pressures aren't necessarily as valuable as sacks, because it, at the end of the day, a pressure could still lead to a touchdown for the offense. So like, I think I just overvalued how consistently he was able to get into the backfield without really looking at like the consistency of his game and his overall effectiveness and his ability to translate that to the NFL, where he's a little bit undersized, not in the sense of Aaron Donald, but he's just undersized in terms of his weight and his play strength, whereas Aaron Donald is just like a mammoth down in the trenches. Easily is just like a gap shooter. And so those guys, undersized three techniques, aren't extremely hard to find. And those are the guys that I think myself and Draft Twitter sort of gravitate towards because they're making those splash plays so often. So that was definitely, I think, a reach on my board.
One of the things,
and I want to say with Easley, like my big problem with him was like repeat knee injuries, and he had the ACL, he had the meniscus, and I know just because my occupational background that and personally from my own injuries that the meniscus is going to lead to kind of arthritic conditions down the road, and I was providing a lot of information about that that year in regards to Easley. It really fell on deaf ears that year. And I think, Ian, you make an interesting point because Easley did make some splash plays, but then you mentioned his actual production and you see that those splash plays, like it goes back to like highlight Twitter, where it's it was Vines until that website went away, but now it's short videos and GIFs and things like that that highlight these splash plays. And then you look at the stats, and we're gonna talk about this a little bit later in the show, but it didn't really amount to any stats. And here's this guy, yeah, not Aaron Donald. He's this undersized, like you said, gap shooter. And year in and year out, Twitter gravitates towards these guys. And not only did they gravitate toward Dominic Easley, they ignored his injuries. And he just has not – he started out his career injured, and then he ran into some off-the-field issues that got him cut from New England. Like Seth said, now he's got a starting role. There's still time for this guy to be a productive player, but he's never going to live up to that draft status. He's never going to live up to where he was picked, and he's never going to live up to where some other people had him ranked.
Well, and I think you hit on something really important, Ian, and that was you mentioned – two guys in Chris Jones and Danielle Hunter who have hit, but Jones was, a middle late second rounder. Hunter was a fourth rounder. That's, that's kind of where you gamble on athletic traits versus production, whether it be one way or the other, right? Like we always talk about, drink Marcus Golden on this show, and he was the opposite. He had all that production at Mizzou and had, garbage athletic testing. And the second round, I still feel was too early, and I'm clearly wrong on that still, but I felt like that was too early. But that's where you gamble for a guy like that. And to see Easley on, as a top 10 player, as a top 5 player on all these boards. The other question I have when you see those things is, what are – like realistic expectations were, and I'm not saying you in general because they're in the same class, obviously, but was Easley supposed to be Aaron Donald? Now, again, you have Aaron Donald rated higher than Easley. So, but was that what the expectation was of Easley, or was he supposed to be, a healthy Geno Atkins? Like what was the overall expectation of him to manifest that type of high level draft status as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's difficult. Like, we know the value of interior pass rushers in the NFL. Defensive interior pass rushers is incredibly high. But there's also a clear chasm, I think, between, like, that Geno Atkins tier and then, like, your rotational guys who can just come in and be, like, what Easley is now, just, like, a pressure creator. There's not a whole lot of in between. Like, you have, like, that great tier, and then you have, like, that bottom tier. And I think if you're too optimistic, like I was on Easley, I think I was probably looking at him to be like an Atkins type, like despite the injuries, despite the lack of production, and that's where you have to be careful. And I've started to draw back and be like, okay, there's one defensive tackle like Geno Atkins and Aaron Donald, like, and Donald's a little bit different too, because of his build. He to me is just a total, like, we can't use him as a comparison ever. And I'm getting to that point with Geno Atkins as well, because if you're constantly comparing a player to one single player at a position, you should probably just stop and just realize that that guy is so one in a million that, you know, he's just an outlier, and that's what he is. Easily, you know, I just think I got too optimistic and wrapped up in what I saw on film. We didn't even see this guy at the combine, but I assumed that he would kill it at the combine, when in reality he was in the 26th percentile at the position in height and the 9th percentile in weight. He didn't do anything else besides the bench. And so we didn't see him be a freaky athlete. And so that's just, and again, with the injury history and everything else, there's just way too much gray area looking back and saying, like, I gave him way too much slack, to be able to be that confident in him.
What about Rashid Hegman? He was another guy. I like to blame our buddy Justice for all of these ones. Hegman, and then you had a good old Scott Crichton as a top 50 player overall. Yep. So, you know, again, this is all on Justice Mosqueda.
Hey, not to interrupt, but we got to mention that Justice called Hegman Wattman, as in J.J. Watt.
And so, yeah, so follow Justice for outlandish pass rushing comparisons at JUMOSQ, and setting the edge that's carried by Charles McDonald at Four Verts, with guest host Justice Mosqueda once every 3 weeks. So.
But the thing is, like, Ian, and you can speak to this, Hegman had good athletic testing.
Yep.
He had decent production.
Yep. Yeah,
how much of a factor is it that he was going to be a 24-year-old rookie? Start with that, and then walk us through the rest of your take on him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I was putting no weight into that at all at the time. I was like, no, that's dumb. That doesn't make any sense. He's just going to enter in as more of a finished physical project. Like, that should be a positive. And the reality is, no, like, that's just the complete wrong mindset. Like, I should have looked at that as a red flag. This was a guy that should have been dominating even more with that physical skill set and at that advanced age. Like, it should have been the opposite. Like, and even if he would have been, it still almost would have been a red flag. Like, you still don't really want a 24-year-old dominating 18-year-olds. There's a reason why we look at, like, fifth-year senior quarterbacks with skepticism, because the good quarterbacks usually come out as juniors. There's not many old quarterback prospects either, for a reason, because they're too good. And so they come out. And so, yeah, I think that, and it's kind of a ridiculous thing to look back and say, like, Rashid Hegman entered the NFL for Minnesota as a 24-year-old as a project. Like, you don't have time for a project. You've got, in this scenario, I had him number 10 overall. That means I'm giving him 5 years. He's already 24. He's got a 5-year contract in this situation. He's going to be 29 at the end of it, so he's maybe got one short-term deal after that, and then he's done. Like, you can't spend half of that rookie contract making him a finished project, or a finished, a finished project. So, yeah, I mean, looking back, the red flags were all over as far as where he was at with his development and his lack of consistently dominating. And, like, you really needed to see the stats there. Like, I'm not the one to be, like, to hold the stats part too heavily. I didn't with Jadeveon Clowney. He was my number one overall player. And I think that may have been a tad high, but I think it's worked out fairly well. Like, I wouldn't really regret that, having him that high. I thought that the film kind of showed reasons why, and he obviously had health issues as well. Hageman didn't really have that same situation as Clowney was. He just was what I looked at as a moldable piece of clay, whereas physically he is, but he's just an old player. So if he was 20 or 21, that maybe justifies that ranking a little bit more. But I think here I overvalued what he did at the combine and sort of justified that maybe he was just in a bad situation, when the reality is there was probably other reasons why he was an old player who was not refined as far as being technique and consistent.
Yeah, and let's talk about some of your hits and misses. This one was you had this guy ranked really high, and he hasn't been a miss per se, but you had him higher than where he went. I want you to talk a little bit about Morgan Moses, who you were very, very high on. He was actually turned into a decent player, and now playing his way into, I guess, a pretty good contract with the Redskins. What made you high on Moses? This was not a player I was high on. I think he was a right tackle only. And can you talk a little bit about the right tackle only and whether or not that's a myth or if that's an actual thing?
Yeah, so I had Moses as the 19th overall player on my board, fourth offensive tackle in the class. I had Zach Martin as an offensive tackle as well when I graded him. But I had Moses beneath that. And I was just a big fan of what I saw when I watched him. You know, I wasn't at the time putting any stock into offensive line athletic testing. I didn't know anything about it. And so he did awful at the combine. The only thing he did above average was the broad jump. That's something that, if we look at the history, the historical data, that's probably a red flag. But that to me is what sort of hints that there is actually a right tackle only position for certain guys, a little bit more of like that road grader, wide body types who play with more brute strength than maybe, you know, getting out there in space. Even if it's, you know, you look at the Redskins and how they play, I think that he fits that situation very well with their inside zone and power schemes, but that may not have worked on every team. And so he was available at a discount, even though the NFL is starting to, they've been prioritizing athleticism at the position, and for good reason. But you look at the right tackles in the NFL, and you would probably say a lot of these guys got that right tackle only moniker as they entered the league. Morgan Moses was a guy. I evaluated him as a right tackle only. I did not think he could make it on the left side, even though there are tremendous pass rushers on the opposite side of the field. There's still tendencies that go with having a right-handed quarterback and having the playing to the strong side of the field. So you're almost always going to be going to the strong side, which is the right side of the offense, because of the quarterback. And that maybe only changes if you have a left-handed quarterback, or for some reason just have a disaster situation on the right side of the line. And even then, we've still seen offenses continue to kind of favor that side for whatever reason. So yeah, I mean, I think Moses, Mitchell Schwartz is a guy, Marcus Cannon for the Patriots, another guy, like, he was talked about as being a guard coming out, but they're able to make it work at right tackle. Most of these right tackles, like, were viewed that way. Zach Strief was that way for the Saints. Jack Conklin, I know some people liked him at guard, but he's been playing right tackle. Juwan James for the Dolphins. So, like, all these guys that I've just named are guys that, for a very specific reason, have been called right tackles only. And the few that have played on the left side, like Juwan James, like, they have not transitioned well to that side. Now, some of that may be muscle memory, and I think that there is something to that as well. Like, you need to do what's comfortable to you, but I also think that it's what the offense wants from the position, the tight end alignment as well, being able to give help to that right tackle position, especially, and the running back alignment as well, being able to give them chips on that side too. So I think there's a lot that goes into it, and a lot of it's going to be schematically, but I also think skill set wise, offenses are used to building around a finesse left tackle and a more powerful right tackle. And what they ask of the guard as well next to them is going to be different as well. So, like, generally speaking, the right guard is going to be a stronger pass blocker than the left guard. And so the center is going to be helping out the left guard more than the right guard. Considering that as well, because of that, you've got to have a little bit more of a sturdy and physical right tackle. At least that's the mindset that most teams have taken.
And you can tell that there is a difference, because when these guys get paid, like Morgan Moses just did, they're getting 5-year deals, you know, for $38.5 million, not 5-year $50 million deals. So a good right tackle costs, you know, $2.5 to $3 million less a year than a good left tackle. If you had to pay a right tackle the same as a left tackle, man, that would be a steep price to pay for two, you know, offensive linemen over, you know, $10+ million a year. So it is, you know, I think, you know, Ian hit on it and did a good job. And, you know, when you look at this, and that's another player that we can kind of talk about, that you probably wouldn't be as high on Morgan Moses coming out now. And so sometimes, you know, you talked about it earlier, sometimes outliers are, you know, are hits on accident, as opposed to, you know, I really nailed this guy from a scouting profile.
Or it's good scouting, because Washington gets Morgan Moses in the third round and he becomes a starter. Maybe the third round is a good place to target a player who you think is a right tackle only, as opposed to targeting him in the late first round.
Yeah, and to that point, you know, it's talking about contracts. I think that's another thing that you really have to value, is right now, right tackles are paid half of what top guards are getting, not left tackles. Trey Turner just signed an $11 million a year contract. Lane Johnson's the only right tackle that has more than $9.5 million per year, and that's because he got paid like a left tackle, because he will be a left tackle. Ricky Wagner got $9.5 million as an unrestricted free agent because he drove up a bidding war, and also because he's an excellent player. But then Morgan Moses also got $7.65 million a year. So, like, there's a clear pecking order when it comes to offensive line, and it's clear that the right tackle is the least valuable position, according to the NFL. Centers are even getting paid more than right tackles. So that should also factor in, I think, to this projection. There really shouldn't be a first-round right tackle if we're going to be judging it based off of contract value. Now, the talent could be worth a first-round pick, but Justin, like you said, when you look at the value of the pick, you're not really getting that value at right tackle when it's literally devalued to the point where it may be the second least valuable position in the NFL based off of veteran contracts.
When you look at the cornerback class, you did a really nice job overall. Two of the one you got, I don't want to say wrong, but one you were too high on, and then one you knocked out of the park. Pierre Desir, you were too high on, and then Justin Gilbert, you just knocked out of the park. And another guy you knocked out of the park that's a safety was Calvin Pryor. But we, you know, we can talk about that maybe on another show. But what did you miss on Desir that you got right on Gilbert?
Yeah, I think I overvalued Desir's personal maturity level. You know, I was able to interview him, saw him at the Senior Bowl. I thought that, you know, kind of like the opposite of Hageman, where I thought he was pro ready, even though he came from Linwood, which probably should have been a red flag, and it was to a certain extent, but I had him as a high second round pick, or like a valuable second round pick. And so looking at that, my expectation would be solid starter. And it would be pretty quickly in the NFL, in my top 50 overall. So I had high expectations for him. I love the length. I like the speed. He was a little bit stiff, and he doesn't always look pretty when he gets the job done. Now, I think he's done decently in the NFL when he's actually had the chance to play. But he's also bounced around now to, I think, his third team. He's with Seattle, and he's going to have the chance to actually fight for some playing time. But my expectation was not that he would ever play for a third team in his first 4 or 5 years. So clearly I was overvaluing something. You know, I like the play in the NFL, but there's something missing there, and maybe it's his ability to play in variable schemes. He's not a very fluid player. He relies on physicality as well, and so that's not easy for cornerbacks. These big corners, they get drafted high, and their leash is very, very small, quite frankly. If you struggle early on, teams don't generally keep trotting you out there. So in the same vein, I thought that he was a little bit more polished, actually, than Justin Gilbert. I thought Justin Gilbert was relying too much on his straight line speed. We saw him playing off man coverage a lot, meaning that he was able to just watch that ball. And when he watches the ball, he can come back with speed and just make the plays downhill. He also had great punt returns and kick return numbers, so he had that added value. But overall, I had him, I think, as a third or fourth round pick, in major part because he just looked like an athlete. He just looked like a guy who could run straight downhill very well, but that's about it. Whenever he turned his back, he was a very grabby player in coverage. He was not confident. He didn't really know where he was on the field as far as being able to guide wide receivers to the sideline, pin them to the sideline. Just a lot of veteran things for a guy who is a third-year player that I thought was missing. He didn't improve at all during his junior year from what I saw from start to finish. And so those were just concerns that I thought that this is a developmental project. Now, he had some of that upside because of the speed, but speed is not athleticism. I think there's a very big difference between speed and athleticism. He ran fast straight, but he couldn't cut. He couldn't cover inside cutting routes. He couldn't get deep outs unless if he was playing off the receiver. And quite frankly, you're not doing that in the NFL. You have to be able to play variable scheme.
Desir was a player who got a lot of all-star hype because he was a Division II player and he was at the Shrine Game. And he then graduated from the Shrine Game to the Senior Bowl, which is always a good sign because it means you played well enough at the lower level all-star game to get that scouts want to get a look at you at the higher level all-star game. But one thing that Seth and I have talked about a lot is that we feel that players often get too much weight put onto their all-star game performances. So what do you think about that? Do you think there was too much weight placed on Desir's all-star game performance as a guy going from D2, making the jump all the way to NFL? And the other thing is Desir's agent is a friend of ours, Greg Linton, who has a great relationship with a lot of people in draft Twitter. And we've met him at these all-star games, at the Senior Bowl. Great guy. How much influence maybe does an agent have when he's a popular figure on that evaluation as well? And I'm not speaking to your evaluation particularly, but just the overall, like Desir was overwhelmingly loved by draft analysts on the internet. And my opinion was that Greg's presence as well as Desir's all-star performance weighed heavily in that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I evaluated the film of him, it's so hard to see. I think he was only targeted something like 20 times in that whole season. So like being able to judge that and accurately, you know, grade that is extremely difficult. And so it was basically all off of what we saw at the Senior Bowl. And what we saw at the Senior Bowl was pretty good. You know, he hung pretty well with quality guys. It was a good Senior Bowl season. As far as the roster there, and he it seemed like he held his own. But the reality is that that's still a tiny sample size as well. It's a very uncomfortable setting for everyone there, especially when you're playing one-on-one. And so I think a lot of that was based off of the All-Star game. It was also an unknown name and an unknown player for the most part. Who's this small school kid that's 6'2", 205 pounds? Like, oh, he can play corner. And this was also during that huge corner craze, where you just got to get a corner who's over 6 feet tall. And so I think that, again, it goes back to a little bit romanticizing the skills a little bit. And I do think that, you know, especially, you know, I have a great relationship with Greg as well. I got to know Pierre. I interviewed him. I talked to him at the Senior Bowl and then interviewed him later. I still have a great relationship with Greg. And so when you talk to people and they instill that confidence in that player, and he should be confident in Pierre as a person. Pierre is a little bit older. He was married, had a kid. It seemed like he could just hit the ground running in the NFL based off of his off the field, but that doesn't always translate to on the field either. Like just being a mature young man that didn't necessarily ready him for the NFL as far as getting on the field early and playing well, even if he was maybe doing well, you know, in other settings. So, I think it does create a little bit of a bias, or at least maybe you're answering questions that you should have had, and you're trying to fill in the gaps because you know the person representing that person is standing up for them and saying, yeah, like, you know, you can trust this guy. He's going to be first in, last out, and all of this stuff. And so you start to assume that they're just going to improve, or you start to say, okay, like, yeah, like, even though I did see them only do this occasionally – he can do that consistently because he's going to reach that level. And the reality is that, you know, maybe he is that person, but you can't always assume that growth, even if he has the character to do it.
I think it's, you know, I think we cannot underestimate the jump that it is for a player to go from Division II all the way to the NFL. And I think that's why we saw Desir actually get drafted in the fourth round, which I don't think was a bad place for him to get drafted. I don't think he was a reach at that point. And I think we would be remiss if we did not say that he fell into what can only be classified as just an awful situation in terms of a poor coaching situation and just a very muddled cornerback room in Cleveland, where Cleveland was still trying to get something out of Justin Gilbert, even when Justin Gilbert didn't seem to even care whether they got something out of him or not. And Desir was probably putting forth an excellent effort, but still being overlooked because of the draft, I guess, capital that Cleveland had spent on. So it's an unfortunate situation. I think, you know, honestly, I think fourth round was a good place for him to be picked. And if he had ended up in a better environment, then we might not be talking about him in the same vein. I do think it's interesting that he's got a new opportunity now where he might finally emerge. But again, he's on the older side of things now. So there's just, you wonder if a guy's already hit his ceiling.
Yeah. There's definitely not much time left for him to really hit his stride, unfortunately. I mean, he could definitely do it. Seattle's obviously probably the best position he could be in with surrounding cast and coaching staff and system. I mean, if he doesn't make it happen there, then, you know, you definitely look back at my grade of him and it just, you know, probably looks silly in retrospect.
One guy I want to touch on, Ian, is a player that Draft Twitter was so high on. I was very low on this guy. You were very low on this player too. Freakishly athletic, fairly productive, coming out of Baylor, and that was Lake Seastrunk. What was it you saw in Seastrunk that made you low on him?
Yeah, so he was a sixth round pick, went to Washington, which is kind of funny. They're running the zone blocking at that time. And what I saw out of him is just a guy that was taking advantage of the spacing that offense created. And he was a good athlete. He could get downhill, but the problem is even when he had a lane straight to the end zone, he would still find a way to veer into traffic and veer into defenders and somehow create contact when there never should have been an opportunity to have contact. To me, he just didn't understand what he was seeing around him. He was a guy, he knew the gap, and once he got into the open field, it almost like he had blinders on, but he wasn't focused on the end zone. Like, he just had blinders on as far as what he was supposed to do and filling his own supposed gap. And he would just completely, you know, mess that up and get out of his responsibility. It was just like the weirdest thing. He seemed like the most unnatural running back really that I had seen at that point. And so it's, you know, you look at how like Ty Montgomery adjusted him and has played for the Packers, how natural he seems at the position, how he could just step in and automatically be productive and be an effective player and show a little bit of nuance. Seastrunk never showed any type of nuance to the position. He danced a lot in the backfield. Even when there was a lane, he was still dancing. It just goes back to his ability to read the field and understand leverage of the defense and where and how he was supposed to react to that. He seemed like he was very lost when it came to thinking for himself and being able to execute, even when everything seemed like it should have been pretty straight for him. He didn't look like a running back to me. He just looked like a guy that was an athlete and they just said, hey, let's just put pads on him and he can play. And I mean, he was fine at Baylor, but you know, you compare him to what quality running backs look like in the NFL. I mean, you're right. Some people had him over, you know, some really good NFL running backs in this class. Carlos Hyde definitely comes to mind. Devontae Freeman, another one, Isaiah Crowell, Charles Sims has been pretty decent. Like, there were some guys that showed some pretty decent true running back skills in this class, but to me, he was never a guy that really had that. I mean, even a guy like Marion Grice out of Arizona State that year, now he was probably like the opposite. Like, he didn't have much of the physical skill, but he had a little bit more of like the polish. He took what was there consistently, whereas Seastrunk would leave a lot of meat on the bone, to kind of go by that Dallas moniker.
Anything else you want to discuss on the 2014 draft as a whole? What you gained from it, or you know, looking back, what you would change? I mean, you've hit on a lot, so.
Yeah, this was a great class to evaluate. I'm really glad that – so I did the 2013 class as well, but my grading scale was different, and there's no way I could just convert that without it being funky. So 2014 was like the first major class I did like over 220 players, which is ridiculous. It's crazy to do that many players. But like for the most part, I think since then my biggest takeaway is understanding where athleticism matters, where athleticism may not matter as much, and sort of correctly identifying which traits matter more and what needs to be strong, and being a little bit more confident in knowing that, and kind of what the history of these positions tells us. I think that we really need to put a focus and emphasis on that. Also balancing out what we see on film as well with some of like the metric things. I'm not huge as far as creating my own metrics, but I know what I trust. And at this point, I didn't know what I trusted in 2014. I was just kind of going with the spark and with, you know, Justice's work is fantastic. But looking in my top 51 at some of these edge rushers, you know, I probably would have changed things up looking back at it. Like James Gale out of Virginia Tech, you mentioned Scott Crichton, however he says it, and, you know, Rashid Hageman, like, these guys shouldn't have been that high. And so you just try to learn from that and look at different skills. Somehow I got D Ford pretty well nailed down, but I missed on Marcus Smith out of Louisville and Chris Smith out of Arkansas.
D Ford had that great Senior Bowl. So
yeah,
we were there. We were there. So we got to see he dominated those backs.
He did. Yeah. He was fantastic. And he finally came into his own last year. So that's one that went from probably looked like a miss to maybe look like a hit. So, you know, it's just a constant refinement process. This is just a fascinating class. This is one that I think that you could really learn more from than I think the 2015 class, and maybe even the 2016 class, just because there was so many good players in this class. Ross Cockrell, Devontae Freeman. I mean, these were mid-round picks that have become really solid players, or really good players in the NFL. So I think this is one of those that the misses are super important in this class, because I feel like when I'm looking back at these, I'm saying, oh, it's obvious. It's obvious why I missed on several of these guys. Now there's a couple that aren't, and that I would really need to dig deep and see why, but I feel like I did a pretty good job of seeing this class pretty well. And then in retrospect saying, I probably wouldn't make that mistake again, but if I did make that mistake, I definitely understand why I did.
And I think it's clear that, you know, when we look at these quarterbacks, especially the takes from, you know, that Seth and I had, that Brendan had on the last show, and that you had, they were still so different. And we see just how hard it is to nail that position down. I think what you said is accurate. There's a lot of things we can look back at with this class and say, hey, that should have been an obvious thing, or that should have been a flag, or that should have been a positive that we should have recognized. But with quarterbacks, it just gets so tricky, and we're still not there. We see how hard it is just to this day. So I appreciate that you're doing kind of this retroactive quarterback work that you're doing right now to go back and take a look. And I know having talked to Justice recently, he's kind of doing some of that too. And I think it's important to look back at those things, because any information that we can glean from this, whether it's from stats or tape or maybe athletic measurements, could be useful down the road. So definitely appreciate your perspective and you coming on tonight and talking about this 14 class. It's easy for you to talk about this because you actually did a really good job on this class, Ian.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to talk about the 2013 class at all.
Well, that's good thing, you know, that was last year's topic, and it was just a total train wreck for everybody. But
That's why I avoided you guys last year.
Thoroughly covered.
Yeah. I didn't message y'all last year about that. I didn't want to talk about that.
That's fair. Well, most people don't even acknowledge that they used to do draft, you know, like 2013, 2014. So
I didn't even know football existed back then. So.
Exactly. Yeah. When you look at these takes, though, these takes that we're giving are always fun because we had takes from 2014 that made us look, you know, silly. And that, you know, allows us to go into the takes that you all are giving us in 2017 that we're going to make fun of in 2 or 3 years and tonight. So let's get started with everybody's favorite recurring hot take artist. And Gam Scout dropped a bomb of Josh Allen, Aaron Rodgers. Now, Aaron Rodgers, the prospect, was clearly not highly thought of. He was still a first-round pick, but it didn't even seem like it was really a toss-up between Alex Smith and Aaron Rodgers at that time. So when you throw out the name Aaron Rodgers, you know, you talked about it earlier that there are certain players that you just shouldn't compare. But when you throw out the name Aaron Rodgers, are we talking the prospect Aaron Rodgers that, you know, went in the end of the first round, or are what are we talking about when we hear Aaron Rodgers and Josh Allen in the same sentence? I'm trying to reason this as much as possible, if you can't tell.
Well, the take was, I watched Josh Allen and I see Aaron Rodgers. He's got everything you could want from your franchise quarterback. So that's in regards to Josh Allen projecting him as a franchise quarterback. So I think we're talking about I don't think that Justin is comparing Josh Allen now to Aaron Rodgers now. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. I think this guy isn't – but I think he's projecting that type of athleticism, arm strength. And one of the things that Aaron Rodgers does probably better than anybody in the league right now is throw accurately on the run. Josh Allen has shown that he can throw accurately on the run. What he has not shown is that he can throw accurately with any – type of consistency. So I think, you know, this is a hot take, no doubt, because I mean to me it is, because I don't think Josh Allen, I think he's way overrated as a prospect. I think when you see those highlight, those vines, those short video clips, you see that type of throw where he delivers an accurate and a strong armed pass on the move, but you also see him you know, he definitely is a guy who trusts his arm too much, and I don't think he's the decision maker that Rodgers is. Now, I don't remember Rodgers as a prospect in 2003. What was it, 2005? Sorry, right? Yeah. In 2005, I don't remember Rodgers as a prospect, and certainly Rodgers had the benefit of, I guess in some circles it would be a benefit to say he sat and learned behind Brett Favre. That's another debate for another night, but I see where he's coming from. I definitely see it, and I'm not going to say that he's a guy, that Justin is a guy who watches only highlights. I know that's not true, so I'm not going to put that on him. But I think it's just a very, very generous projection here.
Yeah, and it's hard to compare him to Aaron Rodgers, the prospect, just because, I mean, I know I've cut two of his games in college, and I think there's like two others on YouTube. So you can't really find it unless if you've got like a stack of DVDs or VHS back then, somewhere around, like it's really difficult to find Aaron Rodgers prospect tapes. And he looks like a totally different player at that point in time. So like he got into the NFL, he changed a lot. His throwing motion was different. He bulked up. And then, you know, whatever else development may have taken place, but we can definitely say that like he changed his throwing motion and became a much stronger player in the NFL at the very least. So I think he's probably comparing him at some point to the pro version. And his strengths, now those strengths are so unique that I can understand why you would glean towards Rodgers, because that's who we think of automatically. We probably say like Rodgers and Stafford for maybe throwing on the run like that. Like there's not too many quarterbacks in Roethlisberger. He's probably another guy throwing on the run downfield is known for that. But yeah, I mean, I'm not huge on Josh Allen. You can go look. There's a YouTube video I tweeted out. Someone cut all 30 of his touchdown passes, and they are very impressive throws, a good number of them. The problem is that pretty much every other throw that he has is filled with a lot of concern. Like, talk about not operating in structure. This is a guy out of a quote-unquote pro-style under-centers system, two receivers, a tight end, a really good running game, and he does not function in structure. Like, he's not getting the ball out on three-step drops, five-step drops. He's surveying the field, or at least trying to survey the field, not understanding what he's seeing, and then just heaving the ball up way too many times. So I think the physical talent is there, just in terms of like the arm strength, the downfield accuracy is very impressive. The big play factor is great, but there's a lot to be desired in consistency. And I'm not one to really point at the stats, but I will say that his completion percentage is definitely reflective of his consistency. Although it isn't a scheme that kind of asks him to go vertical, he definitely exacerbates that, though, because there are too many times when his receivers are doing slants or curls or even deep outs, and he's scrambling around in the backfield, letting them go deeper. And it's like, well, you're just making this issue worse at this point. Like, you shouldn't be doing that. Just get rid of the ball to a dump off or something. So he's a guy that's got to sort of rein it in a little bit. And it reminds me of very early career Patrick Mahomes.
Rodgers was a JUCO guy right before he went to Cal.
Yeah.
And so there's another similarity, because Josh Allen was a JUCO guy before he went to Wyoming. And in his 1 year of junior college, Josh Allen actually completed fewer than 50% of his passes at junior college. Now, I will give credit here, because that completion percentage has crept up and now it's 56%. But it's phenomenal. I mean, it's just amazing to me that DeShone Kizer was punished by analysts for his completion percentage, which, as we've talked about on this show and I've talked about in some articles, without that hurricane game, was for his career around 62%, and people are very high on Allen. Now, what I will say is that Justin Gamel was high on Kizer as a pro prospect, and now also high on Josh Allen. So
yeah, he clearly is a type, you know, which is perfectly fine. I talked about
it's that big, strong-armed guy. Yeah,
perfectly right? Fine. Yep.
And I agree. I think that's fine. It's just that me in particular, I just don't see it with Allen at this point. I think he has a ton to prove, and unfortunately for him, he's lost his top receiver, he's lost his top running back, and he's lost his top offensive lineman as he goes into his redshirt junior year. And I think there's a lot stacked against Josh Allen to live up to the hype that Draft Twitter has laid down for him.
Well, and I think we saw Ben Albright tweet this last week that – what was it, like 70% of the people he polled in the NFL thought that Josh Allen would be the number one pick. I mean, that it's not just Draft Twitter setting that example. And we know Matt Miller of Bleacher Report's really high on him as well.
I think Daniel Jeremiah as well, right?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
so this is not an isolated take. Yeah. You know, maybe the Aaron Rodgers thing is an isolated take, but certainly there are a lot of people high on Josh Allen. I think we, as you know, the three of us seem to be in the minority here.
I think so, but I think it's fair to be a little bit skeptical. It's just, you know, you don't see a lot of quarterbacks like that have a ton of success. But it'll be interesting to see. I mean, if he overcomes the situation this year and does show growth, I think that will speak volumes about him as a prospect. Because you're right, I think the odds are stacked against him of improving.
Right, big game, first weekend of the year, Labor Day weekend, September 2nd at Iowa. So that's a big game right off the bat. He played at Nebraska last year and threw five interceptions, rather famously. So We'll see how he fares against Iowa. They've got some new faces in their secondary, but they still have a pretty veteran front seven, as far as I can tell. So that's going to be interesting. Sticking with our buddy, Justin, you know, this was a big thing. This comes up all the time, right? I mean, this is the age-old argument of film versus analytics, and anybody who's listened to this show tonight or in the past knows that we believe strongly in supporting your film study or your tape study with analytic backup, you know, whether it be stats or whether it be athletic metrics or both, and kind of slotting guys based on that. But he tweeted on Saturday night, and this set off a firestorm. I wasn't around, but he tweeted last weekend, why don't I believe in your predictive modeling and stats-based analysis? Because you made it up. I didn't make up watching the actual game. This speaks to this is a very old-school approach of tape only, and obviously it set off – not only did this set off an argument or several arguments on the night that he tweeted this, but it actually carried over. It escalated. Not necessarily with Justin, but with other people getting into separate arguments. It was like a tree of arguments that came from this, which always happens. So, guys, I don't think I need to get your take on this, but is that an approach that you would use where you just say, like, you know, for example, our buddy Jim Coburn's done a ton of research going back to the 50s. Even using high school stats. Is that something, I mean, how seriously do we take that, and or do we just throw it all out?
I like integrating analytics to help make better decisions. The high school numbers seem extreme, but if they're that strong as a predictor, now I don't think that we have enough of a database to really say, just from what I've seen, you know, there hasn't been that many great quarterbacks to come out in the last decade, let alone like trying to filter it that much down. That's just my opinion, but I like the use of analytics. I think that personally, I'm not smart enough. I'm not good enough at watching film to be able to just say, and we went through my misses. Some of those misses wouldn't have been the case if I would have used analytics correctly. So, and I'm sure I would have been higher on guys if I would have used them correctly. So, you know, I'm definitely for them. I think that there's a happy medium in between. And I think if you're ignoring one or the other, and I feel like his comment may have been a little bit more geared towards fantasy guys, because that's a different world than I think what we look at. But I think if you're totally ignoring one side of the house, then, you know, you're probably missing on guys that you shouldn't.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that is the high school statistics a bridge too far? We've talked a lot about high school metrics, high school athletic measurements on this show, and maybe that's a bridge too far. And I personally think that I missed on a lot of players in the 2014 class because I gave too much weight to certain analytics. I was following Spark very closely at that stage. And I think I've gravitated away from formulas and gone back toward picking out, as you mentioned earlier, Ian, specific traits or specific test results pertinent to the position. I think there are some statistics that are important. For example, a receiver being the number one receiver on his college team, I think is quite important. I think a running back being the workhorse on his college team is quite important. I don't think any of these things are the end all be all, but I think it would be a mistake, and it would lead to mistakes if you just completely ignore those things. And to this, I'm going to throw this one to Seth after I read it. But to this point, this was Luke Easterling's response after Luke Easterling, of course, runs the Draft Wire, which is the USA Today draft site. And this was Luke's response after seeing a lot of arguing on his timeline, I'm sure. He said, regarding the always fun film versus analytics debate, how about we all just evaluate how we want to and stop taking ourselves so damn seriously. Seth, I don't think it's that simple.
No, and one of the things that, like, a lot of people overlook in this debate is that competition breeds success. Competition breeds innovation, and competition's going to breed or force you to work harder, because if you don't, if you're just going to stand on your laurels, if you're just going to continually look at players the same way over and over and continue to make the same mistakes over and over, then other people are going to supersede you in terms of, you know, following, whether that's on Twitter or marketplace, in terms of, you know, working and things of that nature. It that's what happens. And with the NFL draft being as popular as it is, there is space for that competition. It doesn't have to be malicious. It doesn't have to be, you know, in order to, you know, F you or any of that to anybody, but it should be something that is used to kind of fuel and create content that enlightens fans in a way, in a different way than what we have been with, you know, monotone, monotonous scouting reports and lazy player comparisons that are just super unrealistic. You know, you talked about it earlier, Ian, but you guys remember at the beginning of September last year when John Allen was the next J.J. Watt? And it was one of those baffling things because a couple big names said it, and so it became a thing. And then intellectually dishonest may be strong, but it's not an accurate description of who John Allen was as a player. And then you get pockets of people who are actually watching and note-taking and breaking things down, saying, look, John Allen is not J.J. Watt. Don't put that expectation on him. And then you get the rebuttal of, well, you know, so-and-so who writes for, you know, CBS Sports or whatever said this, so, you know, it's accurate and true. And so, you know, that's what I believe in, but I also think that you can be competitive, but still have a good relationship. I mean, you don't have to, like I said, you don't have to be malicious, when you're competing. You can still be like, hey, I think this guy does good work. I appreciate it. And, you know, I just don't agree with it.
So go F yourself, probably not the approach that you would use. Am I reading you right, Seth?
I mean, depends on who it is.
Well, I mean, you say that to me, but not on the air.
Right.
Yeah. Hey, Ian, thanks again for coming on tonight. Very, always enlightening to talk to a guy like you that's done a lot of work over several draft classes. Again, I was fortunate enough to sit with you at the Senior Bowl in 2014. So we had a lot of, you know, we've these conversations kind of go way back. And again, it was fun to hang out with you last weekend and really kind of get these takes out. And it's always fun for the age-old film versus analytics arguments. Those are always fun to me, although I think, guys, have some fun this summer. You know, get out and enjoy your summer, because soon it's going to get colder and we're going to have football to watch and actually analyze. So my advice to all the youngsters out there is just, you know, go out and have a little bit of fun and try to stay out of the melees that we saw erupt on the Twitter timeline last weekend.
I mean, you hit on it though, when you tweeted the next day, that is why
that is why
birth rates are down amongst the millennial generation, because they're too busy breaking down film instead of, you know, going out and having a good time and you know, finding interesting people to hang out with. They're more interested and busy with arguing over the best way to analyze a draft prospect.
To be fair, they did get out obviously the next day and buy up the avocado toast.
Yeah, I know. Bunch of jerks. So, but thanks as always, guys, for listening. We'll be back next week, I think, I'm pretty sure, to talk about who knows what. Maybe we'll do the fantasy stuff that we promised. We've had a couple guys that are raring to go for us. So maybe we'll bring them on next week and talk a little fantasy football. But thank you as always to Ian Wharton. Check us out on SoundCloud. Check us out on iTunes. We'll be back next week, and enjoy your week, everybody.